Hello there, this is Luke Clancy and you're listening to Culture File. On the journey this time, we'll encounter the slideshows and the activism of Nan Golden in Berlin, and we'll pick some plant-based sounds with Athens-based sound artist Fortini Trifbelou. But we begin on the Green Road, which is the title for Chamber Choir Ireland's latest recitals happening in Dublin and Belfast this weekend, and also featuring some plant music, including the world premiere of Gahuna Eachnach, Voices on the Hill, a new choral work from the Irish composer Owen Desmond. At rehearsals this week, Owen Desmond spoke to Niamh Daly about entertainment, holiness and anxiety.
My name is Owen Desmond. I'm a composer and a singer.
Is there anything like particular about, you know, being in the rehearsal space? Like, you are part of the group, so having that sort of like dual role in it?
It's really rewarding. You know, I put a lot of time and effort into the technical side of my practice, but at the end of the day, there are times when I come into a room and they're doing exactly what's on the page, and I'm there going, that's not really what I meant. And I sort of always say that the finished version of the score, I don't like to call it finished until after I've heard a first performance. And one of the hardest things for any artist to do is stop tinkering, stop like fiddling and trusting that. And sometimes people do just read something differently. Even when I'm in the room, sometimes I'll say, oh, well, I intended for it to be this way, and it still won't necessarily come through, or people will have a different interpretation of what I mean when I say, could it be more dancey? And they'll do it what dancey means to them, which is not the same as dancey means to me. And it's really taught me a lot about how a group of 16 people can completely have a different reading of a word like dancey, for example. And therefore, when we're all communicating with each other in any way, we should probably have a bit more patience that for misunderstandings of that kind. So I started to sing at the age of 7 in St. Finbarr's Cathedral in Cork as a treble there, having done like theory and Suzuki violin, and it was in the choir stalls that all the various interests that I had, kind of musical interests, kind of came together. I always loved poetry as a kid, and that was where everything kind of clicked. So I pursued that up through college. When I moved to Dublin, I moved to Dublin to study music at Trinity and got a job at Christchurch Cathedral and then at St. Patrick's Cathedral. And then I joined the Chamber Choir. And I've had a relationship with the Chamber Choir since I was in secondary school, actually. They came to my school to do the Composers in the Classroom programme, and I've been very rewarded to be on the other side of that, going into secondary schools and teaching secondary school kids how to write a piece for Chamber Choir Ireland. It was so rewarding. You know, you go in and often they have a really like preconceived idea of what, you know, they should write, and they're always kind of going, how should I write a piece? And my main goal is going, well, there's no one way to do anything. The Chamber Choir does a huge range of music, not just in terms of time, but even within music by living composers. We do a huge range of styles and approaches and technical approaches, even within one program. So I try to say, well, you think that writing for choir sounds like Mozart's Ave Verum Corpus, which is most people's exposure to choirs is probably in church singing. And I just kind of try to say, actually, there's a whole world of choral music out there and a whole range of expressions and things that the voice can do that aren't just what we sort of think of as choral singing. And I just try to encourage them to like really embrace the massive influences that there are now today in choral music. I like to bring to the music that I'm writing for a group like the Chamber Choir, which is a concert choir, is often a quasi-sacred element to the music making, but I'm not interested in this idea that a concert is a sacred thing where everyone has to sit and not be moved, or if you are moved that you must not be visibly moved or anything. I feel often classical concerts in particular can kind of impose a sacred reading on an audience, that they say, we're going to tell you how to respond to this, and it's not to applaud between movements or between sections of concert. It's not coming from a snobbish, elitist, you don't know how to behave in a concert. I think it's coming from a sincere desire to create a space where people are moved and have an emotional and spiritual response to what they're hearing, but it's almost like they're putting the cart before the horse and going, well, we're going to tell you that's what you're going to encounter, without necessarily saying, well, in order to make that happen, we have to like create that space organically, and you know, we have to work hard to let that happen with what we're doing with our music and our performance naturally and organically. That's what, you know, I like to try and bring that into the concert space, while at the same time realizing the importance that ultimately an audience is there to be entertained. And entertainment takes, you know, all sorts of forms. But if they're just being told, well, you have had an amazing experience, an amazing spiritual experience, and they come away from it going, well, I sat through something, don't really know what it was, then they're probably not going to come back. So I was in the Hodges Figgis new poetry section, Filiacht Nua, where I go basically every time I'm back in Ireland. I love digging out new poets. I picked up this book, Ligd an Ngíoraí Si, Let the Hair Sit, by Ciatán Ní Wealdún, who I'd never heard of before. It's her first published collection. And it's great because on every left-hand page is the poem in Irish, and on every right-hand page is a poetic translation by Paddy Bush, which, you know, it's one thing to have a word-for-word translation, but it is actually a poetic translation as well. And I flicked through it, and I was blown away. It's absolutely incredible stuff. The imagery and the subject matter it's amazingly profound. I think what drew me a lot to a lot of it is this sacredness. A lot of the poems in the book are about Mount Brandon, which is on the Dingle Peninsula where she lives. And it's treated in her poetry as a sacred space, and the climbing of it is treated as a sacred thing to do. It's not tied to a religion. You know, she does mention in one of the poems, Beri Midling or Badgerine, we bring with us our rosary. And then the next line is Nú Patacloch or Worry Stone. And I think, you know, she's using sort of classical Christian imagery and then saying, and there are other forms, you know, this is just a manifestation of something people use in their hands as a fidget toy in order to sort of externalize an anxiety rather than hold it in. Like something clicked in my brain. Maybe it's because I turned 30 as well, but I just started to really, really, really stress about the future of the world. A lot of my work has been reflecting that more and more lately. It started out kind of with pieces that were about the natural world, and increasingly it's almost haranguing an audience into also caring about the natural world. So I've chosen 6 poems about Mount Brandon, which on a physical level detail an ascent from the base to the summit over the course of 6 poems, but also through the poems take the listener on a sort of an eco-spiritual journey. The first movement is to do with preparing for a climb, and it's got lots of depictions of nature. The second movement is the beginning to climb, and again, just lots of nice depictions of nature. But the third movement is quite arresting. Suddenly, it's called Shastir, Stand Back. And it's essentially a list of various creatures and how we kill them. You know, barbed wire, weed killer, you know, essentially how we kill them, not actively, not like a pig to slaughter in order to eat, but like you were driving too fast and you killed a fox. You know, you were spraying weed killer and a badger ate the plants and died. And how the things that we do to try and improve our lives in the world are actually having this hugely negative impact on the world at large. That's the first half of the poem. And it's, even though that's the third movement of 6, halfway through that is kind of the halfway point of the piece. Because from then on, there's the beginning of what I think of as a ritual where you're invoked to re-animal yourself, re-river yourself, re-ocean yourself, until you are infused with the humming of bees on a summer's day, is the English translation. And then the following 3 movements are an embracing of that, you know, realizing that we contain everything within ourselves and we should have a positive relationship with the world, and sail nua tosna hagam, beginning on a new life. So I hope that people leave the concert basically thinking about their relationship with the natural world a little more deeply than they did when they came in.
Since the 1980s, Nan Goldin has been photographing herself and her friends in New York City, documenting them all falling in love, being intimate, struggling, doing drugs, being close to each other, coming apart, living really complex lives.
Don't tell me what to say.
One of her most memorable images is a self-portrait from 1984 called Nan 1 Month After Being Battered, which shows her curly hair framing her face, lips painted red, 2 black eyes, one of which is bloodshot. It's so hard to look at, but also, it's so real. It's part of a series called The Ballad of Sexual Dependency, which includes over 700 photos. I've seen them as individual photographs, and I've seen them in a book version, but it began in a format that is now legendary. In the 80s, Goldin used to edit the photographs into slideshows, set them against music, and show them in bars and nightclubs in downtown Manhattan. The Ballad of Sexual Dependency is my favorite of the works on view.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown when you've got worries.
It's tender, and the music set to the photographs by Maria Callas and Marian Faithful is atmospheric and heart-wrenching. It's such a beautiful work. As a viewer, sitting through the 42 minutes of gradually changing photographs, time passes so slowly. The photos feel decidedly old, of their time in the end of the last century, all these young, beautiful people lying on the beach, smoking cigarettes, dancing in a cramped New York City apartment, spending days in beds together and alone. There are drugs and there are drinks. There's a life that feels like it's always on edge. And there's Golden's gaze, piercing, never letting go, raw and intimate. Love is crazy, love is kind, Faithful's voice sings in the background.
Love is crazy, love is kind, but I know somehow you'll find me. Love is crazy, love is blind. She walks the boulevard without a care, knowing too much, but having come.
Golden's voice is also present. In the most recent work on Vue, Memory Loss, from 2019 to 2021, she uses recordings of interviews and conversations with her friends in the 1980s, all these messages she saved from her telephone answering machine back then. "Nan, are you there?" an anxious voice asks. The image shows a couple having sex, an interior in a hospital room that's so clearly a withdrawal clinic. "Memories lost through drug addiction. I couldn't do without," one voice says. "Still in bed?" someone asks on the phone. "Oh no, I never went to sleep." Memories lost because one's life is seen through the prism of the drugs taken. The work itself is an attempt to destigmatize and also explore drug addiction. Even though Golden documented so many moments of her and her friends' lives back then, she refers to that whole era as a time of lost memory. The exhibition is dark. Walking from one small claustrophobic pavilion structure to the next, I take all these notes on my phone. I record some sneaky videos so I could refer back to them.
My mom and I will live alone. A grand apartment is our home.
I look up some songs on Shazam.
In a fair home towers, I have to keep me company. Two cats, a dog, a parakeet. Some plants and flowers.
It's Charles Aznavour.
I help my mother with the chores. I wash, she dries, I do the floors.
That's the thing. I mean, my whole life is based on memory, so I remember every word that's ever been said to me.
The next day, I go through the materials and see notes like, "to go to sleep and hope that you wake up again the next day." And I can't remember exactly which slideshow or video that was in, or whether that was what I was thinking. How hard that must be, the grief of it so vast. The way the whole exhibition feels like a look back, introducing this sense of sad nostalgia, so human and so very, very real. The sex works on Vue are 4 slideshows and 2 videos. One is about the death of Golden's sister. The other, Sirens, is a companion piece to Memory Lost. It tries to represent the feeling and pleasure and fear and physicality of taking drugs. The thing about these twin works, the one attempting to recreate a sensation, the other looking back at it with all this regret, is that they have the same emotional weight. All the works on Vue feel like they choke you up in the exact same way. They have the same approach and the same aesthetic. There's another element to Golden's voice, and that is her activism. After years of battling drug addiction, in the 2010s, Golden was prescribed OxyContin, a powerful painkiller that's incredibly addictive. It's produced by Purdue Pharma, a corporation that's been criticized for its role in the opiate epidemic in the United States. Purdue is owned by the Sackler family, and if the name sounds familiar, that's because it's above the doors of so many museums and galleries around the world to which the Sacklers donate money. In 2017, Golden founded PAIN, an acronym for Prescription Addiction Intervention Now. It's an activist group that demanded the Sackler name be removed from museums and galleries and that cultural institutions divest from their relationship with the family. The British Museum, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the V&A, theaters, universities all around the world have all removed this name from their doors in shame and recognition. At the opening of the Berlin exhibition, Golden asked the audience to stand in silence for 4 minutes and reflect on the ongoing genocide in Palestine. She then gave a speech for a quarter of an hour, using her biography again, as she did in her art and in her activism about the opioid crisis. Golden described how her Jewish ancestors escaped the pogroms in Russia. The current situation, she said, reminded her of that violence. In Germany, a country with a large Palestinian diaspora and a history of supporting Israel after the Holocaust, Golden insisted on using the space art granted her to use her voice again. She called out Germany for its silencing of protests against the Israeli regime. She hurt with those around her and those far from her. She called for an arms embargo on Israel and for people to channel their grief and anger into action by taking to the streets. The crowd chanted Free Palestine. To talk about Golden's voice, her experiences, her activism, and how she is unafraid to be at the center of this hard, challenging, impossible, painful, and crucial conversation, is to talk about her art and her life, which she documented. The bravery of her art is the bravery of her life, is the bravery of her voice. These are intertwined and on view in this exhibition. It's called This Will Not End Well.
I like to experiment. The first rehearsals are always the most interesting because then you ask them to do whatever you can think, you know, and you're not always sure that that can actually work, because if you're constantly just trying to push the boundaries and experiment a lot, then you cannot really know if it works or not. And, you know, sometimes it can be a total disaster as well. My name is Fotini Trebol, and I'm a sound artist based in Athens, Greece. So I mostly write experimental music, but also concert music, and I'm also composing for films and TV. I like to use typically non-musical systems as music ones, like traffic system and language, the speech, and I just try to use them as music ones. So a couple of years ago, I got a commission by National Sawdust in New York to write a piece inspired by a Greek poet called Sibi Kavafi. And I had to choose one of his poems and picked a poem called The City.
Wherever I turn, wherever I look, I see the black ruins of my life here.
At the roundabout, take the first exit.
I see the black ruins of my life here.
And, you know, the idea was to use the city as a score. Of course, the city of Athens, which I'm a resident in. The poem speaks about the inevitable return to the places that are familiar to ourselves and to our mindsets.
I'll go to another country, go to another shore, find another city better than this one.
Even if you're willing to leave, you will always return unless you change this mindset. And I wanted as well to underline this endless moving around the city. And I video and audio recorded a junction in Athens. So the colors of the cars, their movement around the junction, so where they started from, how fast they were going, things like that, define the pitch, dynamics, and the gestures that the mezzo-soprano sang. So the score's rules were defined, but here the performer was free to choose which vehicles to follow each time. And the voice was heard like as being part of the soundscape, as it was a vehicle as well.
You won't find it by country, you won't find another shore.
The idea of being a sound artist to me is very liberating. It doesn't carry the weight of being a music composer or being a sound designer, so it kind of liberates me. In 2024, I worked in a film called Mauve, and we follow the last moments of the relationship of two people. And the entire film is very surrealistic. It's very packed with information. It all happens inside a house. And it's all filled with plants and it's packed by them. Some of them are still alive, some of them are dead. And one of the two girls, she's obsessed with those plants. She brings more and more and more. And the other one, she's like, I cannot stand any other plants in here. It's like we're also seeing their relationship through the plants. And we wanted those plants to be another role, to be a layer. We used a lot of recordings from plants, so the thorns of the cacti, things like that. And stretched them, created glitches with them. So how I would typically work with an electroacoustic composition. And I created the entire sound design as if it was a music composition from start to finish. So in 2024, I released an album called Loop. I was working on this new project called Electric Sheep, spelled with K's instead of C's. And that project is more tonal and rhythmic than my other compositions are. And, you know, I'm really fond of new technologies, AI, ethics, and science fiction. So I introduced this entity that we don't know if it's a human being, an animal, a virtual entity, an object, a thought, or something in between, that wanders around in a known world and tries to make sense of it and to understand it by recording it. It tries to create some sort of memory to matter as an individual. So memory is important and self-consciousness is also very important. And I wanted to create a world and invite the audience to get lost and wander around alongside our entity. So yeah, it's a story from start to finish. And this is what I always liked about CDs as well, was that you had to listen to the entire thing from start to finish. And in the meantime, you would, you know, read the booklet, the lyrics, if there were any, examine the artwork, read the titles of the songs dozens of times until the album was finished. And then when the album was over, you had this feeling of emptiness, you know, like you have been in a world for 45 minutes or so, and you perceive time differently. It's like a parallel reality. And then you came out of it and something was missing. And, you know, I think that's like magic. Electronics help me create this kind of world. It's my music language, really.
The time-twisting sonic whirls of Fortini Trifplu there, bringing to an end this edition of Culture File. We also heard this week from composer Owen Desmond and Orit Gat's voice notes on the work of Nan Golden. We'll be back with more Parallel Realities next time. Meanwhile, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode, and also for Culture File's special podcast-only treats. Culture File is produced by Luke Clancy. The associate producer is Neil of Daily. It's a Sounds Doable production for RTE Lyric FM.